This is News in No Time at Gordon on today's roundtable. The president once again is struggling in the polls, and an IQ debate raises its ugly head again. Joining us today to discuss these topics and more from our NPR headquarters in Washington, Joe Davidson, an editor at The Washington Post. From member station WGBH in Boston, Callie Crossley. She's a social and cultural commentator on the television show Beat the Press, seen in the Boston area. And Nat Irvin, professor of future studies at Wake Forest University. He's joining us from member station WFDD in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Thank you guys for joining us. Let's go to a story that I think people had hoped to hear differently from the FBI, and that is a story that received a lot of press coverage, the reopening of the investigation, which included the exhumation of Emmett Till's body. We are finding out now from the FBI that no federal charges will be filed for the 1955 killing of the 14-year-old, that they're suggesting the 5-year statute of limitations on federal civil rights violations has expired. And before we go further, we should note that the law was amended to provide for death penalty cases, but it cannot be served retroactively. Joe, I guess the first question would be, didn't we know this from the beginning?
Well, I think that's true. Nonetheless, I think people often, certainly a lot of people, hoped that the FBI, the federal government, would find a way to go back into this case and bring those who are responsible for Emmett Till's murder, those who are still alive, to justice. These kinds of cases, though, it must be said, are awfully difficult to bring, even though there have been some notable ones in the last 10 or 12 years. Byron Dealer Beckwith was convicted for the 1994 slaying of Medgar Evers. You had Bobby Frank Cherry in Alabama, convicted in 2002 for the Birmingham church bombing, which was in 63. Edgar Ray Killen, last year convicted for the killing of civil rights workers in 1964. So clearly it's not impossible. It is difficult, and in this case, the federal government decided, I guess, it was too difficult for them.
Well, you know, I like to say justice delayed is justice denied. That's what Reverend King said, and I just think justice should not have a deadline. You're right, Joe. This is not CSI. It's going to take a minute to try to put these pieces together. On the other hand, what often happened in these cases is that the folks in the community had some link to these people. They knew who some of the perpetrators were. So I would suggest that there's probably some evidence still locally about, you know, kinds of hints that would lead to enough evidence to move on this case. And the larger question really becomes, you know, what is the perception of Mississippi and really our, as a country, are still wrangling around these race issues? This was an opportunity, I think, for the federal government to move forward and try to put to rest some of one of the most notorious cases that happened during the civil rights movement.
And Callie, you beat me to my next question, and Nat, pick up on this if you would. And that is, when you reopen a case like this to the fanfare that the FBI allowed for this without warning up front that the statute was there and it may be problematic, you tend to dash the hopes of many who look to the Justice Department and others to right wrongs.
Sure you do, Ed. And we still have, you know, if you're a baby boomer, black baby boomer, white baby boomer for that matter, the case of Emmett Till still resonates because of the visual images that we have from the Jet magazine photo of Emmett Till's body. I think, you know, when we compare the decision by the FBI, who today has decided not to pursue this case, compare that with the decision by next-door neighbor Alabama to go back and pardon the number of folks who had been charged with violating the segregation laws. You see, a part of our country who's trying to deal with a very painful part of our history, we make progress and we fall back. I think the opportunity that the state has, Mississippi, maybe the district attorney will follow up. I'm certainly hopeful that the folks in Mississippi will not let this thing just fester. This is not something that's just going to go away. We will be talking about this case 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now. And this is an opportunity, while the people are still alive who do know what happened to come forward and help us to heal a very sore and festering wound.
All right, and we should note, as everyone has alluded there, that the state, in fact, can still bring charges, that the statute of limitations does not apply in the same way there. And many people are hoping that the state will pick up from here and continue. Joe, did you have...
One of the things that I think is particularly galling about this particular case is that this is a case that in a sense drove the civil rights movement from the very beginning almost, and so it became kind of an icon of the civil rights movement and what can happen to black people in the South for little or no offense at all. And so I think there's a lot of emotion with this case. Right. As there's certainly, and that's totally understandable. I have a lot of emotion about it, and I think every black person does. And so for this outcome, it feels so unsatisfactory. Mm-hmm. You know, even if on a strictly legal basis, it makes sense. And I certainly don't know all the ins and outs of the FBI's case or lack of a case, but it leaves us wanting because of the power of this case over decades.
All right, let me bring this up in terms of trying to right or wrong, if you will, even though Nat jumped the gun on me there for a second. But Alabama lawmakers are considering pardoning hundreds, even thousands of people who were arrested decades ago for violating Alabama's segregation law. This would, in fact, include Rosa Parks, whose conviction is still on the record. Callie, you know, many people say that it's a nicety, but it doesn't do anything. Others feel that it helps close a wound. What do you think? And we should note that this would be called the Rosa Parks Act.
I think there is power in acknowledgement and that this makes a statement. And a lot of people say to me, well, you know, some of these superficial apologies, what does it mean in the end? Because they're not really sincere. I don't really care if they're sincere. I think there is power in the acknowledgement. This happened. This was not correct. Here are the people who were involved, and we're making an official statement.
But if it's not sincere, what does it correct other than the record, which most people won't go to anyway?
I think it corrects...
Go ahead, Joe.
I was just going to say, I think it corrects a lot. First of all, if you were arrested during that period, as many people were, you have an arrest record. And just in terms of... you know, full disclosure, my former father-in-law is Fred Shuttlesworth, who was arrested many times because he led the Birmingham movement. And so people have an arrest record. And so there's some practical, there's a practical importance to pardoning everyone.
Well, you know, I think I'm with Callie on this. Sometimes, I certainly think it's hard to get to people's intentions when, you know, one of the legislators said he couldn't imagine anybody opposing it. I doubt if anybody would oppose the matter, but there would be people who privately would oppose it. What I think is important, aside from the pardons, and this is what I wish sometimes that we could do in terms of race relations in this country when it comes to our history, if we could just acknowledge that we're sorry for what happened, if we can just find a way for people to just say, look, we shouldn't have been this way. This is the way our country was. There were a lot of people who were silent when things that were being done, when black people were being terrorized by its own government, by the local officials, in full knowledge of local citizens who should have done something about it, and they didn't do anything about it. A part of the healing is just to say we shouldn't have done that. And this is a small step, but I don't see what's wrong with just saying we're sorry. A pardon is a formal kind of declaration of it. But the problem with it is that it says that, you know, you did something wrong. Hell, they didn't do anything wrong. What was wrong was the way people were being treated. And that this is a part of the process, but it doesn't do it all.
Well, for those of you,
I would just like to remind everybody that the first step in any 12-step program is acknowledgement. So we can't even get to talking about any issue beyond that. You must acknowledge first.
Well, we should note for those who are as fervent about this as the panel seems to be, this is being considered. And if you'd like to see it move through, you should contact Alabama lawmakers and say that you believe this is a good idea. Okay, let's take a look at the White House. The president restated his terror strategy in a national security strategy that was released this week. His doctrine says preemptive war against terrorism and hostile states with chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons will continue from the United States. One of the things, Joe Davidson, that people also heard this week were the whispers about how the United States is taking a look at Iran. This, coupled with that, tells us what?
Well, I think that based on history, recent history over the last 4 or 5 years, I think it's the kind of thing that might make Iran nervous because of what happened with its neighbor Iraq. However, I think it should also be noted that that even though the United States invaded Iraq, and even though Iran has long been on its on its watch list of evildoers, Iran is proceeding with its nuclear program. So it's not at all clear that this type of strategy works to dissuade an Iran or other countries from going along their chosen path when that chosen path, conflicts with U.S. objectives.
Callie, I'm curious, when you hear this, when you see the president not stepping away at all, standing in this gale wind, when you see the latest polls that show him at 38 and 36% approval rating, and that 60% of the people are suggesting that the war is going poorly, when you see Howard Baker and others suggesting that a shakeup is needed in the White House, what do you think about this administration that clearly has not moved at all?
It's stubborn. I mean, and the man himself has said that. Listen, I take my stand, I make no bones about it, and when I've decided something is going to go this way, I'm staying the course. I believe that's his terminology. And so that's what I observe. I would hope, and we've seen some evidence, the Dubai thing is one thing, the Harriet Myers thing is another situation, where there have been some forces on his side, per se, that have forced him to back away, change, or adjust. I don't know if that's going to be successful now because he's sticking in there with this war, and
Nat
lots of
Irvin,
folks in his own party are saying something different.
Nat Irvin, Americans some years ago clamored for this kind of politician. Look, right or wrong, stick by your beliefs. We don't want to see this wishy-washy mess.
Well, I tell you, Ed, George Bush's stubbornness has been an asset and is also a liability. I have not read the entire report, this new national security strategy report. I've read some of it. And, I tell you, there are a couple of things. One, I think it's actually there's a subtle shift in this report. And I don't think, even though a lot has been made about the preemptive strategy that one of the president's aides made a point of talking about and the media has picked up on, it's actually less of a unilateralist approach and more of a multilateral approach than has been the case in 2002. In other words, I think what's happened is the administration is talking tough, but if you look and listen, we still have the same principles in terms of what has always been the hallmarks of foreign policy for America. But the fact that we made a mistake with the preemptive strike into Iraq based on false information about WMDs, this administration in this report is saying, they're acknowledging that, and I think that in terms of the country's response, preemptive strike is a no-go. From now on, it is Jerry Maguire. Show me the weapons before you do anything. And despite the whole thing about Iran being our on the axis of evil, I'm not buying it. I don't think we're going to do anything there.
All right, let me get to this very quickly because it only gives about a minute for each of you. But yet again, more data released this week, and certainly we've seen the nation pay attention since the bell curve years ago. This is analyzed by two economists, one from Harvard, one from the University of Chicago, which suggests that there are very small racial differences in mental functioning of children age 8 to 12 months, and in fact that Asian children score slightly below white and black kids. This, put next to what we have seen before, again, Callie Crossley says, what if anything?
I don't know what it says. I just think it confuses people. And I mean, I think we just have to go with the fact that anytime you touch this subject, it goes off into all kinds of tangents. And I'd like to see some more conversation about this from some other folks. This just doesn't make sense to me. I guess maybe I'm not a scientist. I don't get this. I really don't. And I just think it stirs up a pot that continues to be stirred that doesn't have much evidence in it.
Well, I think the bottom line, though, is that the researchers came to the conclusion that there is very little, if any, significant difference in the intelligence of black and whites and Asian babies. And when they did a series of tests, as you alluded to, Ed, in this case, the Asian babies came out somewhat behind. But we know that when it comes to those doing work at the college level, for example, or throughout school level, that certainly is not the case. So I think that this study study basically shows that there is no significant difference, if any difference at all.
Well, it's certainly going to continue, Nat Irvin, the debate between nature and nurture, because as Joe alluded to, after that 11-month period, we start to see the gap widen. And certainly by high school and college, the gap is large in terms of standardized testing.
I used to really get bothered by all this crap by social scientists, the white social scientists, you know, who used to perpetuate the whole this whole idea that somehow blacks were less intelligent than anybody else. And, you know, but I stopped worrying about it. And a couple of things happened. First of all, my wife and I are parents of three children. And when they were born, each one of them was more brilliant than the one that came before. And they are now. And I just, you know, that's the first thing. Second thing is, the more we read about the history of social science and the more we read about science in general, we know less about what we're talking about. And I respect Stephen Levitt and Ron Fry. Both of them are brilliant economists who have these great statistical models. And I appreciate their interest in this area. But it doesn't mean anything to me, because it's not going to mean anything in the future. What is important, as we learn more about us as a species, is that the key thing is going to be working on the environment we live in, trying to provide better opportunities for people.
Yeah.
And I just don't pay any attention to anything that comes out about measuring race and intelligence, because I know
right.
People don't know what they're talking about.
Amen.
Right.
Amen.
Amen.
There's
amen.
No intelligence in the intelligence.
Callie, Joe, and Nat, thank you very much. And the one thing we're sure of is that we'll hear from Nat's two eldest children, or at least he will, because he clearly said the youngest was the most brilliant in the family.
Well, so they're all brilliant.